how wonderful that we're doing all these practices of sitting meditation and walking meditation and making offerings and chanting the teachings and dedicating merit and prostrations and so on. And we might not think that, wow, we're like, this is really great. We're accumulating a lot of merit. Maybe some of you might think that, but I bet not so many people think that so much in our tradition. It's like we're just kind of doing it. And that's the wonderful thing. I think that's what Dogen's starting to talk about here. On the bottom of page one, aspiration for enlightenment, arousing the mind of awakening, happens within arousing the mind of awakening, generating bodhicitta happens within generating bodhicitta. Buddha nature is continuously being expressed from Buddha nature and in Buddha nature and in body and mind. In this body and mind, in the bodies and minds of all Buddhas, in the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow of all Buddhas and ancestors, it actually says. This being so, you could say this inconceivable generation of bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta, the mind of clarity and emptiness right now. This being so, building stupas, creating Buddha images, and other practices right now are exactly arousing the mind of enlightenment. We say, as I mentioned this morning, for I think Dean maybe wasn't here, whoever didn't hear this, that aspiration is just this text translation of bodhicitta is aspiration for enlightenment. And this is like a relative bodhicitta is the aspiration, and the ultimate bodhicitta is Bodhi mind, is the mind, the awake mind. So really all these practices are exactly arousing the mind of awakening, quite literally. So this says, arousing the aspiration for enlightenment, the aspiration for directly becoming a Buddha. But maybe more accurately we say, these practices of building stupas and so on are exactly arousing the mind of awakening, bodhicitta, the awakened mind, arousing the mind of directly becoming a Buddha. So, actually the word aspiration is not really in there. But it's arousing bodhicitta, arousing the mind of directly becoming Buddha. Maybe these are being equated here, actually. Directly becoming Buddha is arousing ultimate bodhicitta. This should not be abandoned along the way. In other words, building stupas, and creating Buddha images should not be abandoned along the way. Such practices are called merit beyond purpose, merit beyond making. This is visualizing true thusness, visualizing Dharma nature. So I don't know why they chose the word visualize here for to translate kan, which is means like to see, or to can mean insight. It's the character for vipassana, but we could also say contemplation or seeing, quite literally seeing. Kanzeon, it's the same kan. Kanzeon is seeing, regarding the sounds of the world. It's kanzeon, or kanon is the abbreviation for the sound regarder. So we could say regarding. Regarding, seeing, contemplating. I wouldn't personally use the word visualizing. I'm not sure where that's coming from. But we could say this is seeing true thusness, or observing true thusness, observing Dharma nature, true suchness or thusness, ta-ta-ta, and Dharma nature, dharmata, are basically synonyms that again mean vast emptiness beyond all our conceptual constructions. Dharmata is a word we don't use so much, but I think it's a beautiful word. It's putting that same ta on the end of dharma. So it's like the suffix dash ness, N-E-S-S. That's how you could translate the Sanskrit ta. So ta-ta-ta means such or thus, and this ta-ta-ta is suchness or thusness. Dharma is like phenomena. It also can mean teaching, but in this case I think more like phenomena. All dharmas are marked by emptiness, means all mental and physical phenomena. So things. So dharmata is thingness, or the nature of things. Dharmaness. So the great teacher Asanga has a writing called Distinguishing Dharma and Dharmata, which is like distinguishing phenomena and the nature of phenomena. And the nature of phenomena is suchness or emptiness. So these are just Dharma words Dogen's using. This is seeing true suchness, seeing the nature of all things, Dharma nature. This is integrating the samadhi of all Buddhas. This is, which is the mind, the zazen of all Buddhas. This is attaining the dharani of all Buddhas. And dharani is like we chant the daihi shin dharani. And so it's like a mantra, but it also has this meaning of like mental command is one translation, or maybe accurately said to be, it's the power of total recall. It's this movie, Total Recall, you might have seen. Total Recall. Dharani actually is the power of total recall. It's used in this different way than like a mantra. So it's like it's the power of a Buddha to basically remember everything in the universe and be able to recall it. So maybe there's some relation between these, that by like chanting, maybe memorizing dharanis helps us to develop this total recall. Mantras in Dharani seem to be like syllables and words blessed by Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, so that when we recite them, we like receive their blessings. We make this connection. Dahi Jindarani we chant in the evenings is like we make a connection with Avalokiteshvara, the great compassion Bodhisattva. So a lot could be said about Dharani. There's a whole fascicle of Dogen called Dharani. But Dogen's just celebrating these practices, the heart of unsurpassable complete enlightenment, the fruit of an arhat, the actualizing of a Buddha. Other than this, there is no dharma beyond purpose and beyond doing. So now, what are we talking about?
Thank you.
So, I just wanted to read the whole paragraph. Basically, you can see it's just Dogen's exuberant celebration of how great these practices of making stupas and Buddha images are, and that they're, such practices are called merit beyond purpose, merit beyond making. So that's one translation. Merit beyond purpose. That's kind of a dynamic word. So it's this beyond purpose. Mu-yi in Japanese. In Chinese is wu-wei.
Wu-wei?
Wu-wei.
The wu-wei?
The wu-wei.
Oh.
You know wu-wei?
Well, it's a Taoist term.
Yeah. Richard maybe appreciates that. Wu-wei. Which literally means like, it could be like translated like beyond purpose. So I think that sometimes in Taoism how it's used is like totally natural, uncontrived activity. Just do it. It's my understanding. Something like that. Wu Wei. Would you two add any more? Yeah, in Tao, it's like purpose is natural activity in accord with the Tao. Yeah.
And what is wu-wei?
Beyond purpose is a translation of wu-wei. And but interestingly, so this Tao, which came first, I don't know. This Taoist term wu-wei, the same exact characters. Wei can mean like fabricated or constructed. So it's like activity, the Taoist activity beyond fabrication or construction. But wu-wei is also the Chinese characters for translating the Sanskrit term asamskrita, which is, this is now Abhidharma again in Buddhist psychology. All dharmas, all mental phenomena are categorized in all these ways, right? And the first breakdown is they're categorized as either samskrita or asamskrita, meaning constructed or conditioned. Compounded, constructed, conditioned. For now, I think, let's just say these are all the same. And almost all dharmas are like this. The five skandhas are all constructed, conditioned dharmas. Their, you know, form arises dependent on conditions, and same with feelings and perceptions. And all these other mental factors, almost all of them are conditioned. Sometimes when you have a list of like, there's 75 mental factors, 72 are conditioned, or wei, we'd say in Chinese, and like there's maybe like three that are wu wei. It's a different meaning of wu wei, but same exact words. So it's maybe sort of a double meaning. In this case, the three the asamskrita dharmas, the unconstructed, unconditioned dharmas, are two kinds of nirvana, basically, or nirodha, like cessation. So cessation of perception and so on. Or let's just say for now, nirvana, the unborn reality of nirvana, is not constructed. It's not fabricated. It's one of the only things. Everything is fabricated, but it's not a thing. And, you know, there's two kinds, but let's not get into that. And then space, space, like, you know, like kind of physical space, is also unconditioned, unconstructed. This was at least the Indian understanding of empty space. It doesn't depend on anything to be space. The things in space are all constructed. So, yes.
I'm getting to what you're talking about. At the beginning of that paragraph, this is what I'd like to hear you enunciate. It's a puzzle to me.
Mm-hmm.
Toward the beginning of that paragraph, where is it? Well, the aspiration for directly becoming a Buddha.
Uh-huh.
The word becoming.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, contrasted or compared with, toward the end of that paragraph, this is the actualizing. Becoming, actualizing, where do you go with that?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't remember. I don't have the Japanese with me right now. That word becoming, but we can see, like, in another translation, what does it say? Directly achieving perfect Buddhahood is surely the arousing of the thought of enlightenment, is one translation. And then this, the manifested part later, or actualizing the Buddha, I did actually write down that that one is Genjo, of the Genjo koan, actualizing or manifesting. So this translation has, for the first becoming Buddha, it says directly achieving perfect Buddhahood, and then it is the manifestation of the Buddha. And then just for one more, reading Dogen, it's great to look at different translations. We have about like five or so of this fascicle by all the our favorite translators. This one says, therefore the present building of shrines, fashioning of Buddhas and so on, is indeed awakening the mind for enlightenment. It is awakening the mind to directly arrive at attainment of Buddhahood. And it's in italics here, which Thomas Cleary does when it's quoting the Chinese. And then later he says, the manifestation of Buddha. So something about, you know, it's something about really direct arriving. Maybe it's like this toku that can mean like for like attaining the way. Yes.
Well, this is a... I'll take a shot at this.
Mm-hmm.
There's... You know, sometimes I don't know if Dogen, if he's just, like, naming a whole bunch of synonyms.
Uh-huh, he often is.
He is trying to say that there's a difference. Mm. A difference between becoming a Buddha and actualizing. But wait, let me...
Yeah.
What resonates for me.
Mm-hmm.
There's something very active about the words, like when he, you know, he'll get into a rhythm, and then he seems to be making it more and more clear to me as he goes through the paragraph, because when he starts talking about integrating and actualizing, I understand that more.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's an activity there. There's a, this being is actually engaging
mm-hmm.
With whatever it's engaging with,
mm-hmm.
right? Which feels a little more clear than just becoming.
Yeah. Well, like Dogen very much likes the word Genjo. He uses again and again. And because partly what it implies is that there's already this fully functioning Buddha nature. So it's not attaining something that we don't have, but it's actualizing or manifesting what we already have. And I think that's why he uses it.
And I think that's too with practice enlightenment, is
yeah.
that we realize it by actualizing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like, oh, I'm going to become a Buddha someday, you know, which is okay. It's like, I am engaging, and through engaging, I am awakening with all things as...
Actualizing it in the moment.
Actualizing the experience of the Buddha Dharma.
Realization is another nice word because it means to make real,
yeah.
And it also means to understand.
Yeah, and actualizing has that same meaning.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, it does, yeah. It means to manifest and to make actual. This translation, just to throw in another one, actually sounds more like what we're talking about. It says, they are the establishment of the mind. He uses establishment instead of arousing. Establishment of the mind, which leads directly to realization of Buddha. So, you can check later with the Chinese. You know, Dogen... I think that I wouldn't make so much of this. I think Dogen's just throwing out all these things, and he maybe doesn't want to repeat himself too much. So he says, well, I'll use Genjo here, so I'll use attained Buddha here.
I also think that it could be skillful means, because different ones of us might relate to different words. And,
yeah.
And if he throws out five or six, then maybe different ones of us will hit it through different angles.
Yep. Becoming Buddha. And actualizing Buddha. Yeah.
And maybe that helps your puzzle, but that's what I think.
I always get stuck on becoming because it implies that it's not yet so. But
I guess,
being and achieving and actualizing and manifesting have a ground of being that it's already so.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think in our wording, Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. That is actually is that character is something like kind of attain. So it's part of the tradition of like this thing of attaining. I think I don't know if it's the same character, but I remember Tenshin Roshi once saying, "What is this attaining Buddhahood?" And it might be this character, I'm not sure, but is it actually another nuance of the meaning of that is it means touch. So attaining Buddha is like touching Buddha, which in English it sort of has that too, like I'm going to attaining the destination of like my finger's going to attain the reaching, it's going to reach the tan, you know, and then it touches. So something like touching Buddha has another quality of like we're not grasping it or getting it exactly, but there's it's an intimacy with.
Well, it's like when we say, I vow to taste the truth of the Buddha's words.
Yeah.
It's pretty darn intimate.
Yeah.
That touch kind of
taste the truth.
Tasting.
Yep. Yeah. So it might be also in this place that Dogen's, when he first brings this up, he's trying to make a really dramatic point. About it, maybe it sounds more dramatic to say actually attaining Buddhahood, and so he's saying actually building stupas and creating Buddha images is directly attaining Buddhahood. It's maybe more shocking, and maybe that's why he says it than they're manifesting Buddhahood. It's easier for us to swallow, maybe. So it might be a little bit of, you know, putting in a really strong image there. So this point that these like kind of simple activities, and maybe we could add in everything he mentioned so far about prostrations and chanting sutras and so on, which we summarize here by making stupas and Buddhas, are merit beyond purpose. Yeah.
About these simple activities.
Yeah.
It keeps helping me to remember the audience for this talk, which you told us a couple of days ago, and everybody might not know.
So, one guess, anyway, is that both this essay and the other, Hotsu Bodai Shin, were taught at Kipoji, which is after Dogen left Kyoto and went into the mountains to build Eheiji, and there was the land was donated, and he and some monks were living in a small temple on the bottom of the mountain. And 5 days because this is all dated, right? 5 days after these were written and presented, they did a groundbreaking ceremony for Eheji. So the one story is that there were all these construction workers around building things. Like maybe they were actually building a stupa. Sometimes I know in the Tibetan world, if they're going to build a monastery, they almost all have big stupas there. They'll first build the stupa because that's like Buddha's mind, and then you build the buildings around it. So maybe something at Eheji and Buddha images, maybe people were carving the altar image for Eheji Buddha Hall. And that there's, so these, we might call like, some people, he would maybe say foolish people, would call these mundane activities not real practice. So one theory is that this talk was particularly given to the construction workers of Eheji, praising their activity as unconstructed Buddha activity. Yeah, so we keep that in mind. And as Hannah pointed out, we didn't really talk about this, but she said when we're talking about the mind of wood and stone, she's like, well, maybe that's because it's construction workers working with wood and stone. So there may be a connection there. Yeah.
But it's odd to me, if he's talking to construction workers, it would be one thing to say this is good works.
Mm-hmm.
This is
meritorious.
Meritorious and a great way to be a bodhisattva. But it's strange to hear him telling workers, by doing this, you're becoming a Buddha now.
Yeah, I think it's because he's Dogen. I think he's like, you know, he's so passionate about this practice, and he's like, I don't want to tell these people they're just doing some good works. I want to tell them you are like, it is like beyond amazing what you're doing here, building this temple. I think that's how I would hear that kind of spirit. And then, you know, there's going to be a long discussion now about what this means, about these doing these simple physical meritorious activities, and whether they're constructed. So mui or wu wei is beyond purpose, or you know, natural or uncontrived. It also can mean non-doing, and it can also mean unconstructed or unfabricated. Right? So these are quite different meanings. The Taoist meaning and the Buddhist Abhidharma meaning, it's the same word, so you could put it either way. And then merit beyond making is musa, is, I think sa is really most literally like making, unmade. You could say unproduced, actually. You could say such practices are called unconditioned, unproduced merit. Or you could say merit beyond purpose, merit beyond making. They have a different feeling, but same direction. And so I think it maybe it's time to stop and look at this issue of merit. Here it actually says kudoku, merit and virtue, which that's what we use like in the dedications. We say we dedicate this merit and virtue. Punya in Sanskrit is really important in all Buddhist traditions, but especially the Mahayana. It's a lot about accumulating or generating merit. And then the Bodhisattva spirit is, after you accumulate it and generate it, you dedicate it or offer it, or transfer it. But what is this merit? It's something that's been really interesting to me because it's hard to understand. I've been trying to look into it. And that right now, my favorite answer is when I was just in Nepal a couple of weeks ago, I got to ask the abbot of Shoho's monastery, a really wonderful teacher. We had a kind of group meeting with him. And we were about to embark on this pilgrimage of like making all these offerings. Mostly what you do at these places is you just get tons of flowers and incense and candles and scarves and food and water and all this stuff, and you just continuously like give it to stupas and Buddha images. And so before we were doing this, and this part of this traditional story is going on a pilgrimage like this is, accumulates lots of merit basically by doing these kind of practices. Like, what is merit actually? What is merit? And he said, any virtuous activity, meaning like any practices that increase wholesome states of mind and decrease unwholesome states of mind, decrease kind, compassionate, and relaxed states of mind, and decrease stingy, angry, uptight states of mind. I thought, that's so simple. I wish I had heard that earlier. That's what merit is. He said, most basically, we could say like that.
That answer totally surprises me because I expected to hear that merit described as a product of those activities. Mm. And you've just described the activities that I think of as producing. It's a wonderful answer, but it also was not where I was anticipating.
Okay. Actually, I can't remember exactly what he said, right? But this is what I wrote just thinking about this. You're right. I think the merit is the result of these virtuous activities, and the practice of generating or accumulating merit, that's generally said to be, this is the practice we need to do, is just doing these actions. Yeah, so actually, what does it mean to generate merit or accumulate merit or gather merit? Means just doing any wholesome practice that cultivates wholesome mind states and decreases unwholesome. And yes, exactly, the result is of these practices is the merit. I was thinking, what is the result? Because we think of it as like kind of like so almost like this magical thing, right? Like I was talking about, we get to gather this ball of merit. These are ways of thinking about it. But I thought, well, what is the result of practicing in that way? It's basically like happiness and well-being and joy and ease, isn't it? I mean, in the most basic way, that's the result of practicing virtuous practices and cultivating kindness and compassion, well-being and happiness and contentment. So that's actually what merit is the mind state that results from those practices. And then that makes sense, then why it's said over and over, we have to accumulate a lot of merit. It's a bodhisattva practice to accumulate merit. Kind of often it's said as preliminary to actually, entering deep meditation. First you have to accumulate a lot of merit. And I thought this makes perfect sense, because if you're not happy and content and basically feeling buoyant and joyful, we can't really, as we know, probably from experience, zazen doesn't go so well. We're just stewing in our stuff, right? But if we like do a lot of just, generic sort of good practices and just be kind and so on, we feel uplifted, and then we sit down on the cushion, it's like, I just feel like ready for basically anything. I think this is very, very practical, ordinary teaching, actually, this way of understanding. It's currently how I understand it. So generating merit is doing these practices to relax the mind, make a joyful mind, which we can do, by certain things do create that kind of mind. Not always, but in general, there's certain things that generally go in that direction. The result is this well-being, and then that becomes a condition for further practices. There's the accumulation of merit. Sometimes it's even said, like I've asked some teachers, I feel like my devotion's not, or maybe I feel like I'm constantly getting distracted from the practice, and I my meditation is not very concentrated. And sometimes teachers will say, you just have to accumulate more merit. Actually, by maybe doing these practices, these traditional things like making offerings and so on. But, you know, I can hear that in the way of, you have to do these, cultivate these wholesome mind states so that you feel this open, kind of buoyant, like readiness to just let go of everything. Yes.
I have a problem with the word accumulating. I like the word cultivating.
Mm-hmm.
But
how about generating?
And that's a good word too. Mm-hmm. But accumulating seems like I get it, I'm doing it, and I somehow or another hold on to it. And I think of these practices of that generate merit, or these practices that you know, arouse bodhicitta or whatever, those kinds of practices are very much the same as zazen. You know, it says in the whichever koan about zazen, one moment of zazen just flows through time endlessly, and I think it's the same way about any kind of generating merit, those kinds of activities, that they change time forever.
Mm-hmm.
In exactly the same way. So,
I agree.
Accumulate anything.
The point well taken. Yeah, I think accumulation also starts to imply like there's some magical substance that you're accumulating, right? Although the term, I don't know, in Sanskrit original, what that is, generate, it might be like, maybe some, generating is kind of like generating bodhicitta, like utpada, giving rise to merit. I don't know if that's what's used. But yeah, I agree. So let's just say, generating merit. I think if we do use accumulation, it's like, I have the sense there that it's not something really that you're accumulating. It's just you're deepening more and more this peace of mind and contentment and joyful readiness. So that you could say, I agree, accumulation is not the best word, but that's the sense I have. Accumulating more and more merit means like deepening this reservoir of well-being. And then this particularly Mahayana, I think it's a Mahayana teaching of dedicating merit, transferring merit, or turning over merit, is such a strange thing, right, that we do at the end of virtuous activities. But now if we see it as it's just the reservoir of well-being, peace, and contentment that we feel, this great, this wonderful result of virtuous practice, then we mentally, because everything is done mentally, I feel great, and I wish to like offer this great feeling to everybody. It's an intention. It's just an intention. Who first? Nunhand.
It also, to me, turns a little bit what we mean when we say dedicate.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I think of merit as an expanded capacity to love and attend and appreciate and understand, deepen.
Yeah, capacity.
Then I dedicate that capacity specifically every moment and every interaction. It's like dedicating in that context also.
Yeah.
Something abstract. It's like whatever I gain, I turn around and every...
Yeah, you could say...
To all beings.
Yeah, and it's like almost like it's naturally happening in that way, right? Yeah, when we feel that, when we interact with beings, it's something kind of radiates out and is transferred. And so I think that's true too. And then we can do these kind of more contrived, intentional practices to remember that by saying, oh, we have this great feeling. And maybe there's sick people that are not in the room right now. And since they're not here, we're not meeting them face to face, let's imagine that we give them this positive energy. That's what we do at well-being ceremonies and memorial ceremonies. So we could say, well, we'd rather just invite them into the room, but they're sick in bed, so we dedicate the merit. And also with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, we dedicate the merit because, you know, we're not, in a way, in certain ways, we're not meeting them like face to face. So, or if we have any doubt about that, we say, you know, however they are, they, you know, are true nature like this. If it's obscured, we, that Buddha, we offer this positive energy. And Tenshin Roshi actually came, like, exploring this, he started using the word, translating merit, kudoku, as positive energy, which has a little different sense.
I have a practice of dedicating my merit, or whatever I want to call it. If I go across the street, I have a little different word, but before I do it, I mean, so anything that I do, I already have sent it out ahead of time.
Before you do it.
That's what Nanette was saying, or not. Mm-hmm. But that kind of, you know, I already know who all my intentions are for.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And anything that I do that is good is already going that direction.
Yeah.
And then the reminders, you know, when we do the dedication, those reminders, of course, are important, because otherwise I forget that's what I'm doing. But,
yeah, so you could do it before, you could dedicate before or after. And, you know, traditionally in Buddha Dharma, like, that would maybe be considered more like bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta, like, I'm going to do this activity for the benefit of all beings. That's going to be my intention. It would be like the bodhicitta at the beginning, and then at the end, when we've actually got the result, then we do. But I think it doesn't have to be that way. It can be beginning, middle, and end. We're offering what we've gathered. And maybe often we do it at the end, like in a service or something. We do it at the end before we start. I mean, there might be a value to doing it before we start, because then we really get into it. We're going to dedicate this service to somebody. Well, we do say that with well-being ceremonies. We're going to chant for so-and-so. And maybe we do actually have a deeper feeling. I'm really going to chant wholeheartedly today because it's for them. That'd be like the beginning. But then we maybe have the feeling at the end, and it's like we wait till we have this positive feeling, and then we're like, now I really feel like I have something to offer. Could be part of why it comes at the end. Yes.
So when I first started practicing and learning about Buddhism and Zen, I was a little bugged by merit because I felt like it was special gold coins or something you give, and I felt like that doesn't fit with my understanding of goal as practice.
Yeah.
For us even to talk about merit. But I
was able
to relax about that because we give it all away. So I thought, well, maybe it's one of these Zen koan things where, you know, don't worry about it because you give it away. And I thought of that as connected to dana and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
From what you're saying now and what others are saying, I'm thinking, I'm hearing it as being a lot more connected to compassion.
Yeah.
Because if the merit that you generate is this reservoir of positive affect, giving it away is precisely not some abstract thing, just to like take your numbers in your bank account and transfer them to another account, but actually the exchange that you have with other people and how you allow the affect to flow in those exchanges.
Mm.
So this conversation is shifting my thinking a little bit and helping me to see it as a reservoir for a compassionate act, which is
Yeah, both compassion and loving kindness. Like, may all beings be happy. And so I want to, like, through me, through this reservoir of happiness. So, you know, we could do it. And I sometimes try to do this, of like, if you're just enjoying some mundane thing, like you're eating some really good food and you feel great afterwards, it's like, oh, I offer this good feeling to all beings. Sometimes you can even, I like to even tie it specifically, especially to like hungry beings who maybe don't have much good food. I offer this feeling of satisfaction. So it's kind of like, may they be happy, and then not the compassion, may they be free from suffering, I think both. Yeah, this way of of thinking about merit is, I think, much more simple than it's sometimes seen. Oh, and another point about merit that traditionally said, that I often found like a little bit of that magical quality that I wonder, what's this about? They sometimes say, they say, as soon as you do the virtuous activity, quickly dedicate the merit. Don't wait, because you can basically destroy it through like unvirtuous mind states. Before you get angry next, dedicate the merit. I thought, that's kind of just a strange way of thinking. But from this point of view, you could say it also kind of makes sense, right? I feel good right now. I feel like happy and open and giving. And I might not 5 minutes from now. So right now, let me offer this before it disappears, either mentally or by like actually meeting somebody and saying, hey, how you doing? You know, because next time I see you, I'm like, I don't know if I'll feel this way. So maybe much more simple than we think. Yes, Lauren.
I'm more on this topic. So my intention always is, in addition to whatever else I do, my merit always I direct toward my children, which sometimes is what gets me here. Because I know that I have the intention of directing the merit for my children, and if I don't do it, if I don't come, that's lost merit for them.
Yeah, could say that. And then we sometimes we direct towards certain people, and Buddhas or Bodhisattvas or ancestors or sick people or children or well-being, and then we have. Actually the word for dedication of merit, the transference or dedication in Japanese is eko, which means like to turn, something like turn over. Actually, it's when we're talking about eko hensho, turning the light around, it's the same e of turning. I don't think it's not the same eko. But turning over the merit. So we have the fu echo is, may our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. And fu means like universal. So we like, sometimes we universally transfer the positive energy to all being, every being and place, everywhere. And sometimes, and you could say, well, does it get more dispersed if you do it like that? Wouldn't you, if you're just directing it at one person, wouldn't it be more concentrated? That's sort of this like magical thinking. And it's not. Even in the teachings it said it's never more concentrated. And there's a teaching too that like you accumulate you generate and accumulate heaps of merit. I mean, the Diamond Sutra talks about that, right? Heaps of merit. You could say, well, if you give it away, isn't that then what about your own evolution? But they say by giving it away, it increases it, which of course makes sense from this perspective, right? And it also is teaching that no matter how, you can disperse it to all beings throughout the universe, and that doesn't decrease it, right? It doesn't. It's not like more concentrated if it's directed towards one person, which makes sense too. Right? Dedication of merit. Also, it's said that. For relative bodhicitta, one of the conditions to arouse the aspiration, when we're talking now about the aspiration or intention, there's our conditions for that. Ultimate bodhicitta is unconditioned. But the relative bodhicitta has conditions, and one of them, traditionally, is generating merit. So again, that I think that's very much in accord with this understanding of, in order to have this wish that like I'm willing to suffer for others and do whatever it takes to realize the complete selflessness of awakening for the benefit of others, it does make sense that we need a lot of well-being.
Yeah, that was just what I was going to say.
Right?
That word.
Well-being, yeah, and contentment and joy for feeling like, I actually feel like a lack. I feel like there's a lot of stuff I need, and like, save all beings? What are you talking about? I got to get my life together first, you know. So, and we do. And if we feel that way, right? And then we do, and then we start doing more and more positive actions till we feel like the more joyful and easeful we feel, the more we can make crazy vows, like, okay, I'll just give this life to all beings. I don't care how much suffering. So it depends on this merit.
Jean?
related to what you just said, a few months ago I gave a talk here about merit. You might remember that. Mm-hmm. I had a piece of fabric that I made today.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And pulling out the little threads by doing good works. Mm-hmm. Getting a little pile of threads of good works. And what is left is the spaciousness or the porousness of what had previously been an obstacle. That meaning the fabric itself. So in a way, what you're now saying is that the activity itself is self-reinforcing and generates more of that same activity.
Yeah, exactly. It's self-perpetuating. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I have to come back to it's actualizing. It's actualizing, mm-hmm. or self-actualizing, what's already so.
Yeah.
So it kind of insists, when we see it clearly, it insists that our activity become in line with the vow. Because it's already naturally in accord.
Mm-hmm. And we could say that the relative bodhicitta, like the aspiration to let go of everything and be completely compassionate, helps to actualize, that relative bodhicitta helps to actualize the ultimate bodhicitta that's already present but is actually kind of hard to see because of all our habits and stuff.
In that way, the word actualize, in Spanish, the word realizar is to actually to make real, to realize cognitively, to make real. And in this way, actualize is to make actual.
Yeah.
That activity of whatever might generate merit makes real, makes it visible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actualizes, yeah. Yes.
I'm going to try and tie this into Jean's, I think, beautiful demonstration, but maybe a demonstration of pulling the string away and creating space. Maybe merit is causing a lot of trouble for us, and maybe the term that you just used, well-being, that this particular action creates well-being of some sort, and as we and that every time we well-being is also self-perpetuating. If we create some well-being, then usually well-being comes from that. I'm just speaking of merit, this sort of charged word.
Yeah.
And two thoughts about what we've been talking about. I think of an example of no merit is one of my, I think probably all of our favorite characters is Ryokan, you know. And I just have the picture of him coming from the woods and then playing with the kids and then going to town, but always having this lovely countenance and this playful and delightful. And I don't think he's intended, he just his passing through life creates well-being. He's not having to dedicate it to anything. Mm. That's one thing. Then there's the other thing, which I also feel has substance to me, is that there's more than what we see, you know. And so inquire, and I think we do it here. We always have a silent 4 or 5 minutes in which we're encouraged to either silently or loud or verbally say the names of people that we're wishing well towards in this created space of sacredness of silence. So that's, you know, a prayer. I mean, and in the world I would like to believe in, there is an energy that moves, you know, and can heal. And people always are saying, you know, in choir, they're always saying, boy, I got well fast. Why don't you guys pray for me, you know? I mean, so there's directed intention for well-being, which is good. And then there's just being, which creates well-being, which isn't directing intentional, but they're both creating well-being. I don't think I'm making any great point here.
Well, I think that like prayer or dedicating well-being is a kind of intention. It's intentional activity, and the more I think about that, in a realm that we live in where every action of body, speech, and mind has some effect. So all our intentions are affecting everything all the time in both conceivable ways and inconceivable ways. So there may be a way, it's nice to not limit our understanding of how far intention reaches in maybe unseen ways. Yeah, because intention creates the world. So if this is merit, then what's merit beyond purpose, merit beyond making, or particularly unconditioned, unfabricated merit. And, you know, one thing that came to mind when wondering that is, what about, so we have these teaching of these six paramitas, right? So you have giving, these practices of like giving and ethical virtue and patience and diligent enthusiasm, meditative concentration. And often it's like those five are sort of like a set of practices that you can just do as practices. Anybody can practice giving. And then there's wisdom that's kind of a special category of its own. Prajna paramita is the understanding, the deep insight that there's no separation anywhere between anything. So then you apply that prajna to the other practices, and so like dana is giving, right? You can practice giving, you can practice dana, but then there's another practice, my understanding is, another practice called dana paramita. The perfection of giving is not just giving. The perfection of giving, or the giving that crosses over, or the giving beyond giving, paramita, is realizing the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift, or the non-duality of giver, receiver, and gift. So it's dana. Sometimes it's even said dana prajna paramita. It's like giving that's infused with this wisdom of non-duality. And so that's one way I can imagine merit, unconstructed merit or merit beyond purpose, is doing these virtuous activities but without the thought of me and the people that I'm benefiting. Like giving is a meritorious practice that results in well-being, but giving beyond purpose or unconstructed giving would be like the paramita of giving, where you're giving something but you're not thinking, oh, it's kind of nice, I'm giving now, I wonder if they'll give me something back. It's just actually like, maybe even in the end, it's like not even any sense of like me and you, but there's just or the gift either, giver, receiver, and gift. We say maybe at some point we change our translation of the kneel chant, because that's one piece that I really miss from the San Francisco Zen Center version of the kneel chant, that the when we open the bowls, we say, Buddha was born at Lumbini and so on. And then we say, may all beings be free from self-clinging, right? But the more literal translation that they use at Tassajara is, may all beings realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. Just before we receive this amazing offering of a meal, may we realize the emptiness of the server, me, and the rice.
So that's why the Dalai Lama said that he has no bodhicitta.
How so?
It's not his.
Empty. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be that. It seemed like he wasn't kind of like coming from that perspective, but it could be that that's what he meant. Maybe we can look at it again. Or like you said, it's not my merit, which is quite similar. Yeah. There's no merit at all. That's Bodhidharma's, one of Bodhidharma's favorite well-known sayings, right? What the emperor asks, what's the merit of building all these stupas and constructing images? No merit. Or unconstructed merit. So now we might think, because of that, then like, because there's really no merit, then why bother making stupas and images and prostrations and incense offerings and all of this? And also, by the way, this is, keeping in mind that as we chant at noon, without incense offering, bowing, chanting Buddha's name, repentance, or reading scriptures, just wholeheartedly sit and drop off body and mind. So that's Dogen talking about Zazen, and it's a saying from his teacher, Rujing. Without these practices, just sit and drop off. So we could take that literally as, don't bother with those practices. But it looks like Dogen maybe did those practices. So, and he's got different essays on making offerings to Buddhas and stuff, and reading scriptures and repentance and all these things he writes about. So we might hear it's like, just do them in an unfabricated way. Do it, you know, bow and offer incense beyond a purpose, or realizing the emptiness of me and Buddha. So, like, we have there's a verse, a Soto Zen verse for prostrations that you can recite while doing prostrations. It's kind of long, so it's easy. If I'll do it, I'll abbreviate it. But it's bower and bowed to. So you're bowing to a Buddha image, right? That on an altar. But bower, me, and the bow to Buddha are naturally empty and still. The bodies of self and other are essentially non-dual. I vow with all beings to realize liberation, arousing unsurpassed mind, and returning to ultimate truth. So it's got Hotsumu Joshi in that verse too. But so we bow in this way where bow and bow to are naturally empty and still quiescent. The bodies of self and other are essentially non-dual, not two. And with that spirit we bow. So it's like a practice that can be just done in a usual fabricated way to accumulate merit, or it could be done with the spirit. And then the question arises, is that the same as like not really thinking about it at all and just doing the physical activity? That's a question I have. Because then you're just going through the motions, right? So here's the form now. You just go like this and you go down. And you don't think about it or you'll be like fabricating something. So just do it. Just do the physical activity. My intuition right now is I don't think that's quite it. Because then you can just be like, you know, why do that activity over any other? Yes.
Because if we think that there is any kind of awareness that exists beyond our thinking, then if we do something that stops us from thinking, it's never empty, because then awareness comes alive without having the confusion of construction and thought, because we're busy not thinking, and now we have alive our awareness. So I can't see empty just doing something, you know, without any, building, you know. That was the point we were talking about before, that doing, chopping water, carrying wood, doing Tai Chi, those things that can get you activated, but with body, and quiet, just like sitting, quiet the mind for a while, but then our assumption is that what's underneath that is native awareness, called Buddha nature. So,
yeah.
That's the beauty of doing.
And it's an expression, it's a manifestation, it's an actualization of empty Buddha nature being expressed. And, I say just to go through the motions, maybe not quite it, because I think there can also be some feeling behind it. Maybe it connects to the well-being part, right?
It
feels like well-being, but I think if we're totally not conscious of even what we're doing, if it becomes mechanical, like just do this because it's the form, right? Then, you know, then there might not be any feeling behind it. So it's something kind of in between, I think kind of subtle, that it's not thinking about like, okay, so what am I going to do? Oh yeah, I'm bowing to Buddha. And like, so that's going to like generate some merit. And like, that's not it. But then to just mechanically do something without any intention behind it or feeling behind it. Also, I think maybe sort of misses the point too. So can there be a feeling of joyful giving without it feeling like me giving to some other? I think this is part of Dana Paramita, actually. It's joyful. I mean, I hope it's joyful for bodhisattvas to practice Dana Paramita. Maybe it's joyful because it's something that we sometimes think of as giving. We maybe have some reservation, like, well, I don't know if I can afford to really give here, and so there's some, that's not maybe so joyful. And then sometimes I feel like sometimes I'm at that point, I'm kind of on the edge, and like, I just do it, you know, just like you're holding back, just offer. And then then there's this joyful feeling, and it may not be exactly Dana Paramita, but it's almost like letting go of the sense of like that I'm going to lose something. It's a wholehearted gift. And sometimes giving to like stupas and Buddha images, I appreciate, because it gets a little bit out of the rational mind of like, well, I'm giving to them, maybe do they expect it, and what are they going to do with it? Does it make sense to give this much to this person? And will they appreciate it or not? It's like stupas and Buddha images always receive our gifts very graciously, and they never want more or less. And it's this thing that's like, it kind of like starts breaking down the a kind of rational mind that thinks, oh, I'm, this makes sense to give like this. So I really got to work with this in India, where we were, you know, spending quite a bit of money on buying like lots and lots of flower garlands, like every day, several times a day, going to the Bodhi tree and so on, and all kinds of things. I had a friend good friend in Nepal who she's never been to Bodh Gaya, and she said, well, you go there and give quite a bit of money from her. It's like, just make offerings to Buddha in Bodh Gaya for me. And so that has this interesting feeling of like, almost hard to use up this much cash, because flowers in India don't actually cost that much, right? So not holding back. And these offerings, these Indian kids, they, once they found out where our guest house was, they'd be waiting at dawn at the door for us to come out to the Bodhi tree. And lotus flower! They'd have these fresh, full-bloom lotus flowers every morning. There must be a pond nearby. And all these marigold garlands and, piles of incense and all of this. And this feeling of like, this is like, this doesn't make any sense. Sometimes be like this huge armful of like flower pile like this, you know, like, can you help me carry some of these? And you just like pour it over the Bodhi tree and the stupas. And then, pretty soon everyone else is doing this too. So they're just constantly sweeping it all away. And so there's more piles up. And we would offer these Kushinagara, this is the big reclining Buddha, like as big as long as a Zendo probably. Like that, and so you can buy these robes, like okesa, like this, that fits that Buddha. Giant, 20, 30 feet long. And those are quite expensive, actually. So the mind starts questioning, like, do we want to actually buy this? Because then it takes our whole pilgrimage group to, together lay this robe over the Parinirvana Buddha as an offering. And then other groups are doing this too, and they're piling up. And then I think that the temple that sells them just collects them again at the end of the day and sells them to somebody else. So maybe we call it a rental. But the idea is you buy it and feel like, could I take it home with me? They probably say, sure. But actually the idea is, no, you're just going to give it away. And it sort of would challenge my rational sense of value and rationality itself sometimes. But the more I would do this kind of thing, the more well-being, like I really feel like joyful. Sometimes like you get a whole, everyone's always trying to make a little money over there, right? A whole group of Indians, they all have flowers exactly the same. Please, sir, these flowers, okay, you just buy them all from everybody. And they're all so happy, and then you become more happy. And then you give them to something that actually is going to not respond at all in the usual way of like being really happy or upset. But in a way, there is a response. Giving to Buddha, I feel very strong response from Buddha back. And what is that? And so there was another practice there we do of like, well, let's actually, how about besides giving all these statues and stupas, what if we give to some people, like actual sentient beings? Because it's good to give to them too. Both, of course, to homeless people, which are everywhere, constantly give. I mean, you have to decide how much you want to give, because it's all day long they're asking you. And, you give a little bit, which for them is a lot. But then also in the temple grounds at the Mahabodhi temple, there's hundreds of practitioners from every country doing their own practices. And one of the practices that we just learned because we saw other people doing it towards us is you can buy like a giant stack of rupees. You can spend like $10 for 110 rupee notes, like 10 cents each maybe, but actually that goes a long way in India. So you buy them and then you just walk around the grounds to all these practitioners and you just start giving them money. And it was so joyful and very interesting too, because some people are like, no, don't, I'm not worthy. or just like give it to someone else. And some people, they're just chanting and they don't do anything. And some people, oh, so kind. And so, but with all these responses, it doesn't matter. Yes.
Well, just you're talking about your experiences in India, and then of course all these poor kids and so forth. And then, I know the caste system is not a Buddhist construct, but how does Buddhism in India interact with and assimilate living in that world of a caste?
Yeah, well, that's maybe getting a little off our topic, but. But there is this caste system, and it's a little bit funny thing. It's not so healthy in many ways. So one response, a kind of modern response, is this person named Ambedkar, an Indian lower caste Hindu, who started reading the Buddhist sutras and said, "Oh, this is interesting. When people join the Buddha's order, they still had the caste system at that time, and." The caste disappeared when you entered the Buddha's order. It was casteless. So that was like a radical thing in Buddha's time to do that. So this person is like, let's do that now. So there's this movement of all these low caste Hindus converting to Buddhism as a kind of political movement to bypass the caste system. As a kind of statement, but I'm not sure all the details of how it's working, but it's a huge mass movement. So amongst this pilgrims from China and Korea and Tibet and Cambodia and Sri Lanka and Thailand, there's a bunch of Indian Buddhists that are generally like in this Ambedkar movement, kind of converted Hindus that are, but not only is it just a political act, they also, they're like, well, now that we're Buddhist, we're taking refuge in Buddha, let's learn some Buddha Dharma, and let's go on pilgrimage, since we live in India anyway, to these places. So I think there's something very sincere about it, actually.
Well, do they gain mobility?
That's what I don't know about how the effects are working, but I think there must be effects because so many people are doing it. You know, that's the question. It's like, do the higher class caste Hindus honor the fact that they did this? We have to look into it. I'm not sure.
What you're describing in terms of these ineffable feelings you have of giving these offerings, it's making me think of David Graeber, this anthropologist, wrote this book called Death. He describes the difference between a gift and an exchange. Is that in an exchange, I give you something worth $5, you give me $5, and our social relationship comes to an end.
Mm-hmm.
But when we often give gifts, what we're really doing is creating subtle kinds of debts to other people that are not discharged in the moment, and that create long-term relationships among people. So I give you a gift for your birthday, and then later on you give me a gift for my birthday, and each time we give that gift, one of us incurs a debt. A subtle friendship debt that you would never want to put a dollar amount on because you can never make it equal again. You wouldn't want someone to give you a gift and then you say, "Oh, thanks for that gift," and then on their birthday be like, "Here, this gift is equal."
Yeah.
Exactly. You're like, "Oh, weird." Mm. No, I want the gifts to be a little unequal, right? So that our relationship has to continue.
Mm.
So this manners. I know it sounds like I'm going way off on the side, but it'll come back. Miss Manners has this thing where she says, "You cannot put on your birthday party invitation, please no gifts," because that suggests that you expect that people might otherwise bring you gifts. And we have to try to understand that a gift is something that is given without and received without any precondition. And that's very radical.
Mm.
And that's very hard for us to actually think about gifts in those ways, of having no expectation of even receiving or not receiving a gift. And that radical conception really forces us to break away from the ways in which we wish to create and sustain obligations through gift giving. So what you're describing is actually sounds to me like a practice in which we're really asked to and invited to let go of giving as something that subtly creates obligations on the part of others as a result of being received.
Yes, I think so.
And that generosity can't really be generosity if back in the back of our mind we're thinking, well, I'm giving you the gift, and you're not exchanging, you're not giving me an equal thing back. But really, we're creating a debt bond of some kind of a relationship. And in fact, instead, to have this sort of karma-free relationship is one that doesn't carry any... That's how we discharge the karma and break out of samsara. So this giving the gift to the Buddha is really someone who neither expects a gift nor repays the gift in any particular way. And there's no rationality. You're talking about the irrationality of the gift. So that's framing what you're saying, but it's inspiring all of these...
I think that's very part of the tradition of Buddha Dharma, my understanding of Dhamma, and how, you know, Buddhist communities were mostly supported by Dhamma through all these centuries. And the feeling is like, in a way, there's an exchange. It's like you're giving to the temple, like people here are supporting this temple, right? You're giving, in a way, it's getting something back, but it's not so tangible. And it's so nice that it's not so tangible. It's so nice that it's not like, well, does my donation, is it actually getting the effect of how much I'm getting out of it? It's nice to not think that way, right? And it's nice to, this is so much more part of like the Asian Buddhist culture, you know, this gift-giving thing is just like really, really flourishing. And like you're giving to teachers that you maybe, they don't give you any teaching even, but you just meet them and that's what you do. And you don't get anything back. But then mostly what the teachers are doing is they're just passing it on to the gift projects that they're working on. So, there's this really like free flow of giving without, I think it's more in that culture of like we're not actually really taking up the practice of not looking for is there some obligation thing going on here. It's hard to do that. Yeah.
Last thought about that. If we could say giving is really love and appreciation, and another word that I like that I have found has been a constant teaching to me, because I don't think I knew much about it, and little by little I've learned a little bit about it, is the term gesture. A gesture is, well, I think it's a gift, but it's not, that doesn't have the entanglement of the gift or the back or the this. It's a gesture. You know, and
sounds maybe
somebody flowers as you come to their sesshin, and that's just your gesture, you know, making them. I mean, you know, or you do it with a loved one or whatever. It's a little different to me than a gift. I like the word even, and somehow there's something embedded in that that tells me, oh, do that more.
Gesture, yeah. It's almost like it's smaller. It sounds less exalted than gift, which is kind of nice. It's just a gesture.
It's a gesture, and it could be. Well, I don't know. It has to be small, just because it just means it's not solicited, you know, and it also doesn't ask anything in response.
Yeah.
It's a gesture, like I'm not asking anything back from that. It just feels good, you know.
This, I'm very excited. This gives meaning to what I think we haven't understood, which is the, in Asia, the traditions of bringing gifts to the temple, but not sitting zazen. They don't practice, they just come and give gifts. So this is a practice.
Deep,
meaningful practice.
Hopefully so, right? I think there is, as we talk about merit, I think there are sometimes, if you talk to practitioners in Asia, this idea of this kind of magical quality of merit, like almost like luck. There's this luck thing that's mixed in. It's like a folk. It's not Buddha Dharma, but people start interpreting it that way. Like, if I do these practices, make these offerings, whatever, then maybe I'll get a raise at my job or better grades at school and stuff. Some people, I think if you ask them, they'll say, yeah, I do think that's true. It's kind of like maybe in all religious traditions, there's some form of this kind of thing, right? But I think that the root of it, and many people are, yeah, in this way of like, it's generating merit of well-being for giving a gift. Because the well-being, therefore the merit slash well-being is more when the gift is just given with no expectation in return. You could say, oh, it's more merit, that would be the unexamined way to say it. But then we say, oh, but actually if we're talking about well-being, you actually do feel better giving like that. So
at the Korean Zen temple where I practiced in Chicago, we were asked to bring food and put it on the altar.
Mm.
And often nobody was in the room.
Mm-hmm.
You brought and you just went upstairs and put it on the altar. So it was your offering. Nobody knew who
it was. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really.
Yeah. Anonymous is really nice, actually, because then you know you're not getting any special credit. Yeah. And then another thing about offerings, it's sometimes said making offerings, particularly to Buddha images, and like the practices we do are, which I find interesting, is there's really no difference between mentally created offerings and physical offerings. I mean, now we're talking about to the Buddha images, right? It may be a little different to humans, but I think that's a kind of intriguing thing to say, like, if you're doing with this, the mind and spirit of true offering, then you can physically offer the incense, which is nice. Or you can, if you imagine offering the incense, sometimes it's said that that's exactly the same result of merit. So, and I think this points at the fact that actually all of this is just mind training. It's cultivating this well-being through its mental training. And to physically do it, especially in ceremonies and things where it's not like actually somebody's going to be fed or not, to physically do it, as I think someone mentioned, is actually adds in this element of the body and mind are connected. So if you embody something, it actually like sinks in deeper to the mind. So that's why I think we have these practices, like actually don't just think about it, paying respect. I mean, prostration traditionally means like respectful homage. So you could just say homage to Buddha, but then you can actually put your body on the floor and it actually, maybe eventually anyways, do that and you start to actually feel that homage, respectful surrender to Buddha's mind more by actually physically giving something. Even with some sacrifice, we were having a discussion recently about incense offering and thinking, some people are allergic to incense, so what about these? And we're talking about alternative things to offer, and I was thinking, there are all kinds of things you can offer, but it's nice if you have to actually, it feels like you're actually like giving something maybe valuable or nice, of course, right? So the fact that like, you know, we have our like incense budget, you know, for the temple and the treasurer's looking at the incense budget. You know, we're using more incense for these things now and it's actually costing more, so when we raise the budget and in my mind I think, oh, this is so great. We're spending more money on incense. It's like we're not getting anything back from that, right? It's just a pure offering. It's irrational, and that's what's kind of sweet about it. You know, we need is a place to just meditate. We just need some cushions and a floor and a roof. And we're just going to do this practice, this technique of just sitting and letting go. I think it would have a different quality than all this stuff that we ought, that we add in, making Buddha images. We're lucky to have Sally here and Sashin to hear about this, the merit of making Buddha images. Sally produced the image of Manjushri on the altar that, I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but I don't want to even get into like the size of the heaps of merit from such a thing. And I think it's, and maybe it is inconceivable because she might feel like, ah, you know, I forgot that I made that until I came here, actually. But we're like relating to it several times every day. So it's like a lot of energy is going into this image of this great wisdom bodhisattva. So I think maybe that's the unconstructed merit. That Sally might be like, it was no big deal. I like making art anyway.
Sand painting.
Yeah. You construct something beautiful and then you destroy it. And then there's, you know, there's Tibetan sand mandalas. They gather all the sand and then they usually pour it into a river to kind of like offer, kind of symbolically offer the positive energy from that project to all the like fish and sea creatures and to carry it downstream into several states. Another thing to contemplate is, you know, making offerings to stupas and Buddha images. Is this symbolic activity, or is it actual, just pure activity? Is it represent something, symbolize something, or is it actually the activity itself? So we offer the well-being we might feel, and even the well-being we might not feel, but it's somehow lurking around to all beings everywhere. May the precious mind of awakening arise where it has not arisen, and where it has arisen, may it never wane, but further and further increase. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.